Good evening, everybody. Thank you for those that are joining us live, and thank you for those that are joining us via the recording. It's lovely to have everybody on this book club. Tonight, I'm absolutely delighted to have Emily Buchanan, who will be interviewing Jimmy Burns about his new book, A Faithful Spy. And we've all had the copy. It was all a signed copy. There are more treats to come for our book club members. So let's just sit back by the fireside and enjoy the talk and the conversation. And we'll be talking for around about 40 minutes with our guests, and then we're going to open up the panel for you to ask whatever questions you've got, either to Emily or to Jimmy. So without further ado, over to you, Emily. Many thanks.
Thanks so much, Amanda. Well, welcome to everyone, and it's lovely to talk to Jimmy about his extremely informative, extraordinary book, actually, and apparently unique because it's very hard to write a book about a spy. There's just not normally any information about him.
Yes, absolutely right. I want to just thank the Tablet as well for having us on, and Emily, who's a veteran colleague like myself, and we've known each other for a long time, and it's great for her to, I feel privileged to have her sharing this fireside chat. I suppose just to start from the beginning, how did this book come about? It wouldn't have come about had it not been for a message I got from the then late Walter Bell, who had died, from his widow, Tatty, who I knew, as I did know Walter by then, who said, come round to our flat because I'm going through all Walter's stuff and deciding where it's all going to go. And I've got all his papers here. Conversation I had with him before he died, we decided that we wanted you to have them. So I sort of turned up in Onslow Square, which is where they lived near the Brompton Oratory. And to my horror, I just was confronted with all these boxes and these papers in no particular order, which happened to be his personal papers covering almost from childhood right through his career, which he had accumulated.
And this is unusual, isn't it, for someone in his profession to have kept things, to have even been allowed to keep things?
Yes, very much so. I mean, just to give you an idea of how unusual it is, I gave a rather more private talk than this one the other day at a London club for members only. And the person chairing it was the former head of MI6, Richard Dearlove. He'd read the book, and he said, he started off by saying, actually, part of me says professionally, you're a very naughty boy, Jimmy. And Walter sort of should have handed in his papers or destroyed them. But having said that, he went on to say, well, actually, if he'd handed in these papers, probably the public would have never had sight of them and your book would have never been written. And he followed that up by saying, as a result, you produced a book which actually, I believe, in fairness, is about an important cog in the history of British intelligence in the 20th century.
And did you have any sort of moral qualms about actually making all of this public?
No, I didn't actually, because I think for me, what was important was having the permission of the family, which went beyond his wife, but obviously it began with that. It also went beyond the grave, because I was certain, having got to know Walter over several years, that he had decided that once he died, he wanted his story told in some shape or form. No, I didn't have any moral qualms at all, actually. And in fact, I felt that I was duty bound to give myself in the best possible way professionally, to not only drawing on the papers, but also double checking and cross checking a lot of his assertions, because of course you can never be sure how memory tends to distort.
So you were faced with all these papers, and you've done a book where you've started really with his childhood, which was an interesting childhood, wasn't it? His father was a high Anglican vicar. Yep.
Well, yes, in a way, his father, George Bell, the Reverend George Bell, broke with the family ancestry. I mean, believe it or not, but on Walter's side, his grandfather, Adolphus Bell, was the founder of the News of the World in the 19th century. I have to say that when he founded it and in the first few years when he had ownership, it was quite a serious paper. It didn't go on to become, you know, forgive the expression, the screws of the world, as it became eventually known as. It was a serious Sunday paper, which is reaching out to the emerging working classes and saying some interesting things. And that was on his father decided to break completely with his ancestry, as I say. He had a vocation because he'd been working with an Anglican priest in the East End of London among the poor, and he followed his vocation. He studied for the church and became a reverend vicar, almost a figure out of Trollope, really, for a while, in a Kent village called Riverhead, where he established himself, as you say, as a high church Anglican, quite influenced by Newman, I think, but very, very high church Anglican, you know. From all the accounts from the parish records and things, he was a very active vicar, much loved by his community.
But it wasn't easy for Walter, was it, being brought up in that household? I mean, it probably gave him, what, a strong moral compass, but at the same time, you write about how his father made Walter go to confessional with his father, yes, giving him confession. I mean, that's a kind of extraordinary.
I think that's one of the traumas of his childhood. I mean, can you imagine having a father who is a priest who, on top of that, insisted that he takes your confession, which is completely breaking every kind of rule in the book, really, even the Anglican rule of the book. But the other thing that Walter remembers from his childhood, because it's in his papers, was that he had to write on a piece of paper every time, as his father put it, he sinned, and he'd write down on a piece of paper. And Walter, who actually was quite a naughty boy, ended up dropping these bits of paper around the garden on the way to his father. So by the time he got to his father, he's, I haven't sinned. But yeah, he was very traumatized by that and actually rebelled by it. We can get into the next period in Bell's life, but it had quite a lot to do with what he became.
Yeah, because you write about, obviously, he grew up and then, you know, he was an adult then in the early 30s, which is when the MI6, the Secret Services, started to be interested in employing him. But he took a pretty dim view of the church at that time, didn't you, the Catholic Church?
Yes, well, he was quite torn. He very much, as you say, belonged to, he belonged to a generation in the 30s. I mean, he was 26 when he was recruited by MI6, relatively very young age. He got into MI6 through actually his contacts with the establishment, because he knew, for instance, members of the Ligon family, which Evelyn Waugh used as a model for Bryce had Revisited, who had connections with MI6. And he knew someone who knew someone who met him in a club, who then introduced him to the head of MI6. That's how he got in. But you have to think back to what the 30s were like. And it was, you know, Europe was in tumult. Walter, as a young student, had traveled to Austria, had traveled to Germany, had seen that the emerging horrid nature of Nazis. You were becoming torn as an undergraduate between basically two ideologies and a very difficult moral choice in ideological terms. Either you went for communism or you went for fascism. And I think what began to save Walter even then, although he was at the London School of Economics under the influence of a very Marxist professor, Harold Lasky, and selling the Daily Worker on the steps of the London School of Economics, he began to take a real interest in what we now refer to as the Catholic Revival of the 30s. Jacques Maritain, the great French humanist philosopher, and Christopher Dawson, who followed Maritain's flag, really. And he took a real interest in that part of of secular church that was building bridges across secular Christianity and drawing on traditional Catholic social teaching as a kind of imperialism at a time when you had Stalin in Russia and you had Hitler emerging and Mussolini emerging in Italy and Germany.
I mean, I found this part of your book so interesting because my mother grew up in the 1930s and she was attracted to communism, but not, I don't think, a sort of Stalinist communism. It was simply what you did when you saw what was going on and the sort of injustice and the inequalities. And a lot of young people were attracted to communism. And it's interesting that given Walter Bell's sort of left-wing views that he didn't actually become a communist.
Yes, and there we get a bit into the title of the book, you know, because he obviously was part of the generation of the Cambridge Five, as I write in the book. He knew and worked with Kim Philby in MI6. He met Guy Burgess, and he in 1946, after the war, he worked in the Washington Embassy with Donald MacLean, another of the Cambridge Five. But I think what, you know, I've mentioned the Catholic revival. He was already interested intellectually in that and theologically in that side of Catholicism. But at the same time, what he was really rebelling against, just as he rebelled against his father, prompted by the Spanish Civil War, was that side of the institutional church that was actually backing Franco. Yes. For Walter, who was very against the appeasers, Chamberlain's government, was very pro-Churchillian, Churchill in the 30s. He, in terms of taking sides in the Spanish Civil War, that comes clear in his personal papers. He was very much on the side of the Republic.
Yeah, he talked about the Catholics being, you know, supporting fascism, and the church has become, he says, the rallying point for reactionaries the world over. So that wasn't the kind of church.
No, it wasn't the part of the church
at that time.
No, absolutely not. And then he gives us an extraordinary description of when he arrives in New York on his first posting. He goes to St. Patrick's Cathedral and he hears a sermon by a Catholic priest talking about the need to, you know, like the Sermon on the Mount and be good to the poverty. And then he said, I walked out and all I could hear was the crackling of dollar bills, you know. And all these horrible bishops who were asking us for our dollars, you know.
It's straight out of the scene, overturning the tables of the money changers.
Very much, very much so. Very much so that you could see the analogy.
So let's go to that period then. He was in New York. He was a young Secret Service officer with a cover, wasn't it? He had a cover job working in
very
the
bad cover. I mean, can you imagine having a cover called the Passport Office, which actually existed MI6 through the 20s and into the 30s, and thank God they dropped it with World War II and beyond. But the Passport Office was, you know, ridiculous because the Passport Office happened to have offices in part of the British consulate in New York, but MI6 had their private offices in there and pretended they were walking in and out of the consulate office, but in fact they were up to other things.
But I wonder, it must have been quite difficult for him because he was actually quite critical, wasn't he, of the British government's line. And MI6 was supporting appeasement and he didn't actually agree with that. So it must have been quite difficult for him. I mean, not only as a spy are you sort of leading a double life, you're also not necessarily agreeing with the people who are your bosses. I mean, it must have been a difficult time.
Well, I suppose going back to the initiate, you know, how we began this conversation, I think, you know, what is extraordinary about his personal papers and what's so unique about it is that you get the real human narrative of what it's like to be in the secret world. A kind of narrative that you don't get from digging up the archives or even the Foreign Office archives or some of the MI5 archives, which have been declassified. MI6 archives remain classified because, you know, the kind of Whitehall speak is almost denuded of human content. And what you have through his papers, as you so rightly point out, is this constant questioning, not just of his intelligence bosses, but particularly of his political masters. And of course, that has huge analogies to our contemporary experience, because how many kind of wars that we've lived through, or decisions that have been taken by the powers that be, that I know for a fact, because I know some of the current people in intelligence, they really dispute it. You know, I mean, like, you know, begin with the Iraq war and the weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist. And you get that, but going back to Water, I mean, particularly during the 30s, his letters to his mother and his older sister, which are very personal, almost like a running diary, where he opens up his heart and his mind and his political brain. He's incredibly critical of the appeasement of the British government. And also, as you rightly say, of at the time, the high command of MI6, who were also appeasers, because whereas Churchill in his wilderness years, as we all know, was warning right back since 1935, 1936, of the looming storm that was coming over the horizon of Hitler, MI6 chiefs and Whitehall chiefs and the foreign secretary and the prime minister were all saying, no, we got to talk to Hitler, we got to find peace with Mussolini. And he was absolutely incandescent about this in his letters. And I suppose that takes one to the complexity of the soul and the mind of someone in the Secret Service. John le Carré, in one of his books, Agent Running, uses a term which, like so much of le Carré, he actually drew from talking to his MI6 mates. And he talks about the camel's syndrome, that camel's back syndrome, which a lot of intelligence officers or people in the secret world develop, which is a sort of a psychological traumatic state, which is described as there are so many things that you have to keep secret, but there's so many things that you really want to say. And the burden of that cracks people up. A lot of MI6 people after World War II had nervous breakdowns. I know that for a fact from talking to their children and talking to my late father, who knew a lot of them, because of that burden. Water survived that. And there we go back to this leitmotif, which is, what saved Water from cracking up? And I think it was his search for faith, which was not dogmatic, which was not in the end ideological. And it was really going for the true faith, which was really his conversion to Catholicism.
Which was later. I mean, you're not, you know, that's the 50s. We're still in the 30s and then the wartime. But it's interesting, you're saying it was a constant of lifelong quest, as it were.
It was a lifelong quest, which the moment of conversion, actually, as you rightly say, comes when he'd already moved from MI6 to MI5, but at a time when MI5 is not what it is today, only essentially based on internal security. At that time, under Attlee's government, it had priority over foreign stations in the colonies. So that's why Water goes to Kenya, Nairobi, the end of the 40s, and he's station chief. He goes to Delhi, he's station chief, and he goes to the West Indies, and he's station chief with MI5. But it was in Nairobi in the late 40s, in the build-up to Mau Mau, that just like Graham Greene, when he went there as a journalist for the Sunday Times, he was hugely impressed by the selfless sacrifice of the Irish missionaries among the poor of Africa. And that's what actually got him converting to Catholicism.
Yes, along with being pretty nonplussed by the attitude of the British colonialists towards the Kenyans.
Pretty horrified by the attitudes, precisely as you say, of, totally racist, white supremacist of most of the colonialists, and the colonial service which he had to serve, who were incapable of realising that Mau Mau was not just a bunch of natives who've, you know, rather like Graham Greene described, as if Jeeves had suddenly changed colour and began stabbing his master. It was the emerging African nationalism, based on years and years of inequality, of land grabs by the whites and social economic inequality.
So this was another time when Walter Bell was just out of step, in a sense, with the people who were running things with the government.
Yes, he was always, I always thought he was always one step ahead, actually. I mean, the other curious thing that I kept asking myself with the evidence of hindsight about why Catholicism and why then, if you think of it, sort of Walter converts Catholicism in the early 50s. By the early 50s, Walter would have known that the sort of search for Soviet penetration of British and also American intelligence, which was beginning to become more evident, and that there were moles right at the heart of the system, i.e. they were closing in on what eventually became known as the Cambridge Five. And it began with McLean in Washington, because his conversations with the Russians were intercepted by American intelligence, and they passed it to the Brits. Of course, the Americans thought the Brits just couldn't ever discover the Cambridge Five, because they all went to public schools and they all went to the same clubs, and this was a very English kind of party. But you know, Walter would have been deeply aware, and I think would have been pulled in for questioning. Why? Because, as I said earlier, in World War II, in MI6, he knew Philby. He rather liked Philby. He went out with Guy Burgess on a famous pub crawl, which I describe in the book, which was called the Karl Marx pub crawl, which Burgess insisted on taking him on, because Karl Marx used to, while he was writing Das Kapital in Soho, used to follow all the pubs up Tottenham Court Road towards his house in Hampstead. You can still do most of those pubs, by the way. We should do it one day. It's quite fun. And it's and then, of course, he knew Donald McLean. So he would have been pulled in for questioning almost certainly, both by MI5 and MI6.
That must have been that whole disillusionment. I mean, he's working with these people. He probably, as you say, he maybe liked them. He thought they were, you know, maybe didn't like the drinking quite as much as they did. But, you know, to feel at that level of penetration, and then the suspicion that then is cast on him and his colleagues. I mean, who can you trust after that?
Yes, it would have been enormous psychological pressure, as you suggest. All the time, he was, I think, keeping his sanity by writing his letters to people he trusted in his family and to his friends, writing himself a kind of running kind of memoir, which gradually built up in what I call the Walter Bell Papers, you know, and which Peter Hennessy, when I told him that I'd written this book, the eminent Peter Hennessy, saying, "Jimmy, you've struck treasure," which was, I thought, very typical Peter, you know, because it was a sort of that's kind of, yeah. But I mean, you know, Walter, I mentioned at the beginning how it was I came across his papers, but I obviously knew Walter. How did I knew? I mean, 40 years separated Walter Bell from me. Okay, so how did I meet Walter? And this will be given the audience we're talking to and our hosts. My father, my late father, as some of you will know, was editor of the Tablet during quite a long time, actually. And I was, while he was editor of the Tablet, trying to make my way in journalism completely independently from him, which meant going as far away from Catholic journalism as possible and joining the sort of heart of capitalism, which was the Financial Times. And I became a foreign correspondent, and I was posted there with my wife, who's listening in, and arrived 3 months before the Falklands War. And so I was the only full-time British correspondent there. Just to fast forward, by the time I was returning to London base, as it were, my father said, "Look, there's a friend of mine who really liked to meet you for lunch at his club, because he's very, very interested in what you have to say about Argentina, what you've picked up and all that." And I knew straight away that, knowing that my father had worked for British intelligence during World War II, that his friends, in inverted commas, were probably not miles away from the intelligence world. Anyway, I was told to go to the Travellers, And I arrived at the Travellers, and I was told that Mr. Walter Bell was waiting for me down in the basement, which is where the bar is, for those of you who haven't been to the Travellers. Very small bar, very intimate. And there was a sort of tall, quite stooping fellow with striking blue eyes and quite handsome, but, you know, already in his 80s, already having got through, so I could see about two or three dry martinis. I joined him on the fourth. And by the time we'd had lunch, we'd got through about two bottles of claret. And so we got to know each other pretty well. And from there on, developed this sort of wonderful, almost from his side, mentoring. He was hugely interested in international affairs, obviously hugely interested in what I was doing. I went on from being a foreign correspondent to covering counterterrorism, intelligence, security, and defense. So we weren't sure.
Was he your source then?
I couldn't possibly comment, but I mean, certainly wasn't my only source, but he certainly introduced me to quite a few people, yeah.
And what was he like? I mean, did he seem somebody who'd sort of been had a difficult life or had to really work things out? I mean, what was your impression?
Well, I mean, there's a book of psychology essays written by a famous psychologist called Churchill's Black Dog, and it talks about how, you know, Churchill had this black dog, which was his depression, and Churchill dealt with it by painting and indeed writing. We all have our depressions. Walter was a total manic depressive. He had his very, very dark moods, to the point that he called his drinking his infuriators, because unfortunately, the more he drank, the more morose he became. It didn't really work for him. But yet, like so many in his profession, he'd been drinking quite hard since the early 20s. Behind all that was some of the things we've been touching on, but was the certain traumatic experiences of his childhood. He always had this sort of, he was carrying the sense of guilt, which I could never quite get to the bottom of.
And his father, that's right, his father had a lobotomy.
His father had a lobotomy because one day in his late age, the police rang up the family and said that he turned up in Chelsea Police Station saying he's going to kill someone along the King's Road. And it was obviously the beginning of a condition. Now, we now know by bipolar or whatever, he was, in those days, the only way they dealt with it was by this awful surgery that actually left you in a worse state than you'd gone into the surgery in most cases. But he always he did have that dark side of him, and I think he for the reasons I was saying before, he was struggling with how much he could share. And how much, from a purely professional point of view, he had to keep secret. I have to say, in fairness to his memory, otherwise I would have already been jailed under the Official Secrets Act, it is that he was meticulous in his papers, not giving away the names of very important agents who would have been covered by the Official Secrets Act. And I certainly, I mean, you asking me before about whether I had any moral doubts about writing the book, I certainly wouldn't have named people that he didn't himself want to name.
And it wasn't easy for his wife, was it? I mean, Tatty, you knew as well. She sounds like quite a redoubtable lady who somehow managed him over all these years.
Well,
didn't have children in the end, did they?
No. He was, as I said, he joined MI6 in at the age of 26. So can you imagine, he's a bachelor. He arrives in New York in the 30s. So he spent his late 20s, early 30s as a bachelor in New York. By all accounts, and I tend to suggest that in various parts of the book, he was not short of ladies that he had various affairs with, but he went through World War II as a bachelor, and then in 1946, when he was back in Washington, serving in Lord Inverchapel's embassy, when Lord Inverchapel, a rather eccentric ambassador, was the first British post-war Ambassador Washington, he was introduced to Tatty, or Catherine Spatz, Tatty as her nickname went, who was the oldest daughter of General Karl Spatz, who was the person that Eisenhower in World War II rated as his probably his best general. He was head of the US Air Force, head of Bomber Command on the US side, who led the whole bombing campaign in France. And Tatty was a real catch. I mean, there's a photograph I put in the which was in the archives of the day of their marriage. And they got married in a friend's house in Georgetown, and they're cutting the cake with the Union Jack on it and an American flag on it, and she looks like a sort of Vivian Leigh, you know. I mean, you know, incredible kind of swan neck and green eyes, and a very, very beautiful lady. And by all accounts, by that time, she'd gone to a very good liberal education, and she'd had her own war. I mean, she was an extraordinary story of Tatty's, that she insisted to her father that she wasn't going to go stay in the States during the war. She wanted to go to Europe. And so she ends up with the sort of mobile units in US bases in near Cambridge during World War II, feeding donuts and American beer and playing rock and roll and keeping happy the poor old GIs and pilots who were one in every five weren't going to return from France because they'd been shot down, but they wanted a bit of America in Cambridgeshire. And there was Tatty and her three other girls of the Dakota unit, as they were called, North Dakota unit, feeding donuts and hamburgers and in the picture of Cambridge. We're not going to the Union, but some of the famous pubs in Cambridge.
And but their paths actually crossed later, didn't it?
They were introduced.
Well, I mean, do you think, I suppose one of the problems for someone like that is, you know, when they look back on their life, you know, did he feel he had actually achieved a lot? I mean, he was in America at that key point when the goal was to make get America to join the war, and he was a key player in that. I mean, did he feel he really influenced that and helped Britain's war effort?
Well, it's a good question, because in a way, one thing he was never was boastful. and his papers are remarkably incisive, refreshing, revealing. I never get a sense from him, from his papers, of him sort of consciously putting himself center stage. But all the things that you've just said are absolutely true. He played a critical part as part of the MI6 station in the 30s against the current. I mean, in 1938, I mean, analogous with, you know, those who voted for Trump and may continue to vote for Trump, 70% of the American population in a poll taken in 1938 were against the US going into another European war. And that was the challenge faced by the MI6 station in New York, which had to really work, not just work the room, they had to work Georgetown, they had to work the State Department, they had to work the American media, they had to work American public opinion through networking, through human intel, through literally just good social networking to try and turn this opinion around, which they did pretty successfully. And of course, you know, Water was awarded, very, very rare for a British civilian, the US Medal of Freedom in 1947. And his citation, which I quote in the book, leaves no room for doubt that whatever was the detail of what Water was up to during World War II, it was key importance to the Allied effort in mainland Europe and the relationship between the British and the Americans.
But he would have had to have adopted subterfuge, maybe some lies along the way.
I mean, he was involved in covert action. And I think, again, I devote a whole chapter to this. The one thing that does come out through his papers, which goes back to this camel syndrome The one thing that really did nag on his conscience was that one of the areas I believe that Walter was involved in was in contacts with German anti-Hitler conspirators during World War II. As some of you will know, there was a decision taken on quite early on in the war at one of the summits at which Stalin, Roosevelt and Churchill were at, where Churchill and Roosevelt agreed, and obviously Stalin was over the moon with the idea because he didn't want these Catholic anti-Hitlerites taking over Germany after Hitler had gone, that they would not authorize politically nor incentivize any contact with the anti-Hitler conspirators. And Walter had it on his conscience that, of course, as a result of this, despite all his best efforts, all these guys kept getting arrested and executed by Hitler in the most appalling ways, you know, where they were actually almost martyrs to the cause of freedom and democracy.
So at the end of his life, do you think he felt, I think you said earlier, you know, was it the Catholicism or was it his search for religion that had saved him? Do you think it did?
Yeah.
Well, in his retirement years, I mentioned that their flat was in Onslow Square. He literally religiously used to go to daily mass at the Brompton Oratory, which slightly paradoxically, because having read, you know, Jacques Maritain, Christopher Dawson, become a trustee of the Tablet under my father's editorship, was very pro-Vatican too, ends up going to this sort of bastion of, I've got all the respect in the world for the Oratorians, but, you know, this bastion of tradition and dogmatic doctrinal theology. But basically what he was seeking there in his early daily mass was the sort of basically the quiet prayer which he sought to try and, I suppose, deepen his search for faith, which he found part of his journey, which intensified as death approached. And I think I went to his requiem at and actually made one of the eulogies at his requiem, and it was a very moving requiem chosen by Tati, and I think partly by Walter, and then Tati, who was actually as her father had been brought up as a Lutheran, but quite a lax Lutheran, also converted in late life to Catholicism, also had her requiem in the oratory. She died about a year and a half after Walter. And then I tell the story of this extraordinary thing that, you know, when Tati died, they were going through her papers and started finding boxes, and I was called in and I was told, well, actually, we found Walter's ashes, and which Tati had kept. And then, so the decision was taken because Tati had asked for it, that her ashes would be mixed with Walter's. And as I can probably reveal, his ashes probably loamed, their ashes loamed Onslow Gardens.
Extraordinary. And of course, there was a role, just briefly, Brompton Oratory had a whole role in the later. In the spy world.
Well, yes, the irony of the Brompton Oratory thing is that this I sort of discovered later because, you know, as some of you will know or would have read about, but of course one of the difficult to imagine now with Putin around, but we did have a period when we thought, oh, right, the Iron Curtain's come down, the KGB's suddenly becoming incredibly friendly, we're all going to be best of friends, the Russians are investing heavily in the city, buying Chelsea Football Club, all sorts of things. And one of the things was sort of increasing friendship, inverted commas, between the Russian secret services and MI6. And we were getting quite a lot of defectors coming over to us with some you know, some crown jewels, you know, some really interesting stuff. One particular former KGB officer who was debriefed by MI6 handed over quite a lot of detail about how at one point during the 80s, this was before the collapse of the wall, Moscow Center, i.e. the KGB in Moscow, was operating through their main London station, who in turn was managing one of their agents. And one of the drops, i.e. the drops for secret documents, was in Brompton Oratory by the Pietà statue, which may be familiar to some of you, which is actually also the war memorial. And what's extraordinary, you might ask, what the hell were the KGB doing using that? Well, the answer was given actually, again, by this defector in the sort of internal documentation, because the Russian manager of this agent said, well, we can't use Anglican churches because they belong to the state. But these English Catholics, of course, they've got a longer history of being independent of the state, and indeed some of them were martyred by the state. So we won't be observed going into the oratory. And that was all in the KGB files. So Walter, I think, I don't think he knew anything about this, but the fact that when he was praying in one side altar, on days when he wasn't there, the KGB were dropping certain documents by the Pietà. So next time you go to the Brompton Oratory, say a prayer at the Pietà and say a prayer for Walter.
Well, thank you, Jimmy. Fascinating. What an irony. It's time for questions, I think. It's just gone 22. So if anyone's got any questions, I think you just unmute yourself. I think that's how we're doing it. Do feel free to just... probably easier if you just say the questions rather than write them down.
Well, and if you can sort of just say who you are, so I know you're not KGB or MI6.
I think Harold's got a question.
Can you hear?
We can hear you.
I'm Harold, LSE graduate. So I like the pictures of the canteen in the book. Thank you for the book. But it's a much bigger question, which you or your father may have been able to. I've always been fascinated as to why Franco didn't join the Axis during the war and remain neutral. And I read a book on Gibraltar during the war where my father was stationed in the RAF. And if Gibraltar had fallen, I think the war in the West would have been lost or considerably prolonged. And Do you have any, is there any information as to why Franco remained neutral when he was accepting Nazi bombers during the 30s? And, or is it just too broad a question?
Well, Harold, some other listeners might think, what's this got to do with the Walter Bulbo? But I'm actually delighted you've asked that question. I mean, on two counts. One, I'm also an LSE alumni. I'm a postgrad from LSE, so we might have bumped into each other at some point. Walter himself... was himself didn't go to Cambridge. He went to LSE under the legendary 1930s Marxist professor Harold Lasky. But to go to your question, evidently you haven't read another book of mine. In fact, the only other book I've written, apart from a book I wrote on the Falklands War, which has quite a lot of on intelligence, but the other spy book is I've written other books, including about football, which have got nothing to do with espionage. I don't think so, anyway. I wrote a book called Papa Spy, which was basically a book about trying to answer the question, which many of our generation did: what did you do in the war, Daddy? You know, because. When I was at school, and I went to Stonyhurst, some of you will be familiar with a good Jesuit school. We always sort of marched to the war memorial and very proudly shown all the wonderful Stonyhurst old boys who died very gallantly in both wars. I always sort of thought, well, my father was never in the military because he never talked about being a soldier in the war and things. So what did he do? And it was only as I got older, I realized that he'd been in Madrid during World War II in the British Embassy, as a result of which he ended up marrying my mother, otherwise I wouldn't exist, and my Spanish mother. And so Papa Spy actually turned into a book that answered that very question, because what the British Embassy was heavily involved in, including my father, was actually in ensuring at a time when Franco was definitely being courted by Hitler, and as you know, during the Spanish Civil War, received a lot of military support from both Mussolini and from Hitler. Precisely covert diplomacy, bribery of Spanish generals, of Franco officials, to ensure that once the operation for the North African landings had been planned by Eisenhower and by Churchill, that as you rightly point out, your father would have known this in Gibraltar, that Gibraltar was going to play a key role, because the troops were going to launch their North African landing from Gibraltar. And for that to happen, we had to have Franco on side, not literally, you know, giving support of his own military, but turning a blind eye to it. Not quite a blind eye, but what the first order he gave was that the guns, the Spanish guns, which were in Algeciras pointing at Gibraltar, overnight started turn the other way, which was quite helpful. But behind all that, much more important, was getting Franco's guarantee that he was not going to allow Hitler to launch a counteroffensive by coming down from France across the Pyrenees and trying to take Gibraltar and fight it out. And that turned really into, it was a turning point in World War II.
Yeah.
I mean, I tell the whole story in Papa Spy. So I if you haven't read it, I do. I'd be interested to see what you think of it, particularly given your dad was there during the war.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great. Any more questions?
I was rather hoping that Brendan would launch in with a good Brendan Walsh question.
Are you at home, Jimmy, or is it Emily's fireplace?
This is a secret.
Location.
Secret location.
Not to be identified.
Not to be identified. No, it's not home. It's all I can tell you is it's not home, but it is a secret location.
Secret location. Absolutely not. No.
I was going to. Well, how about when you came across what Peter Hennessy described as a treasure trove? And knowing, few people know more than you do about how the, you know, spying and the MI5 and all the rest of it operated. When you were going through the papers, was there something that, a couple of things that really gave you a wow, you know, gosh, you know, I thought I knew everything, but that really did bowl me over. There was something, some letter or some little nugget of information that stunned you about, maybe it was about the 30s or the 40s. Was there something like that that just blew you down when you're going through those papers?
Good question, Brendan. I mean, in truth, I mean, I had to go through, I was under pressure to go through the papers and go through them in some detail and not ignore them. And I had been ignoring them for several years because I was writing other books, as you know. And Kidge, my wife, who's, as I said before, is listening in, sort of told me one day, unless you do something about these boxes, I'm going to shred them. So I was under the cosh by a certain date. That's, as you know, being married to someone who's Irish, you know, the Irish wives have a certain tough way of of ordering oneself. But look, I divert. But in answer to your question, I mean, the more I started going through the question, going through his papers, I was just every day having separated his life into, you know, these are the letters from this period, these are the letters from that period, these are the letters from that period. There wasn't one single period that I wasn't at something that actually, as they say in journalism, jumped out of the page, literally, because it was such a sort of unique insight from the coalface, you know, because, you know, we've all had discussions over the years about is history written simply by the top names, you know, I mean, beginning with Churchill, you know, I mean, he rewrote British history, you know, according to Churchill, you know, you know, then Napoleon did the same in his papers. But this was a guy, as I said, when we were earlier discussing this, that was actually giving himself his heart and soul, what he was really thinking, you know. And so some of the things that jumped out was what he was telling and feeling about certain events which were incredibly important in his private correspondence with his mother, who he was very close to, much closer to than his father, and as I said earlier, to his older sister, in which, for instance, you know, during the 30s, and he's working with MI6, he is incandescent about the appeasement at the highest level of the British state, at the highest level of the establishment, not to talk about the Tory party. I mean, he just couldn't believe it. It went against everything his instinct told him, having, as I said, traveled as a young student in Germany and Austria and seen what the Nazis were doing. And also, given that he was working as part of the building of the consulate, hearing what the Jewish refugees arriving in Ellis Island, coming to the British consulate, begging for visas, were telling him. So, you know, that was an eye-opener to me. What, you know, the inner story, the inner narrative, counterpointing the official kind of intelligence, Foreign Office, diplomatic history. Correspondence with particular people, which showed just how that he was in important things. I mean, you know, that there were private letters from Edgar G. Hoover, head of the FBI, on first name terms to Walter. You know, there was, you know, CIA people whose names I knew who were writing personal letters to Walter way beyond World War II. There was the extraordinary relationship, which I go into in a chapter called Brothers in Arms, with Dick White. I mean, Dick White was probably one of the most legendary and most famous intelligence chiefs of the post-war. I mean, he served in World War II as well. He was unique because he was the only chief that became head of MI6 and then head of MI5. And he was embroiled in the Cambridge Five thing and the post Cambridge Five. And he and the friendship between Walter and Dick White that comes through the correspondence between him and Dick White is absolutely fascinating, including the fact, which I think I mentioned in the book, that it was thanks to Walter when he was trustee of the Tabloid that Dick White, who was an Anglican through and through, and probably totally anti-Catholic at half of Whitehall, was convinced to subscribe to the Tabloid. And you know, there's a wonderful letter of Dick White saying, "Yeah, I'm so glad you put me onto the Tabloid because it's such an essential weekly read." I mean, this is music to your ears, Brenton.
And Jimmy, in the was Walter a trustee in the 60s and 70s, that kind of period? I'm just wondering how helpful was he to your father when it came to the, not the power struggle, but the tension over Vatican II with the Woodruff era passing into the Burns era? Was he an ally of helpful when the Tabloid kind of distanced itself a bit from what the church was doing in the mid-60s, that period.
Yeah, I think I mentioned before that for me the slight paradox that, you know, that Walter started going to the oratory, but yeah, he was very pro-Vatican too, and certainly would have supported my father through, as you know, very challenging times, particularly over Humanae Vitae and the tablet stance on Humanae Vitae. I think in truth, Walter, as you know, my father, because of his World War II experience and the friends that he continued to have after the war, he did also surround himself on the sort of secular side with I would say Catholics in fairly key positions. And I'm talking obviously Foreign Office, I'm talking about Ministry of Defense, and I'm talking about intelligence. These were Catholics who in the 60s and 70s were in all those positions, also in the BBC, who he met in his club or in their club, who occasionally came to the so-called tablet table, and who certainly informed some of the strictly non-theological editorials. So, you know, there was that side to it. And I think that the sort of, but for Walter, he definitely was Vatican II. There was one box which I would have loved, I could have written another, you know, sort of 30,000 words, really. But, you know, I was told by my publisher, max sort of 100,000, it ended up at 120,000. But I had a box called The Oratory. And I mean, if I would have been writing simply for a, I suppose, a very, very strict, I suppose, religious, non-secular audience, I would have put this into the book. But since I'm in such good company, I would share that in the oratory files, I came across this extraordinary letter from Walter, exchange with the then provost of the oratory, absolutely furious because he had, Walter had been to a, I think, a requiem mass at the oratory with my father, and that my father had gone up to communion and that the priest had refused to give him communion when he put his hands up. Walter, I think very courageously of him, actually wrote, I have a copy of his letter to the provost, and the reply from the provost. The reply from the provost was actually incredibly, surprisingly apologetic, but I think sort of really trying to get out of it without being drawn into a huge controversy, by claiming that the priest who had done this was not a permanent oratorian. Gosh. But I think that for me, that sort of struck me as, you know, Walter really sticking up for a kind of church he certainly believed in. And just like my father, because they were the same generation, I mentioned before that, you know, my father, for instance, you know, his real interest, what drew him into Catholicism as it drew Walter in theologically, was the writings of Jacques Maritain, Christopher Dawson, all that kind of secular, humanistic Christianity, Catholicism of Maritain, which of course gave them an alternative to the dogmatic ideology and the materialism that so many of their non-Catholic friends were feeling they had to take sides on, or indeed getting utterly traumatized by not knowing which side to take.
And politically, thanks, Jimmy. He was very centrist too.
And politically, yeah. And
he was an SDP, wasn't he?
Yeah, and of course, that's the other thing. Thanks for reminding me that you know, the other thing I dug up for the thing was, you know, Walter, a certificate, Walter Bell, founding member of the SDP, you know, and signed by Shirley Williams, and obviously he'd befriended Shirley, and by that time, he thought Labour was going down the wrong way. He thought that, you know, he'd given up on the Tories years before, and suddenly saw this, particularly because of Shirley Williams. And I think he respected Jenkins as well, and to a certain extent David Owen. He didn't doubt signing up to this project, which, as we all know, turned out to be slightly short-lived.
Jimmy, I've got one question just in the chat box from Harold, so we'll squash it in quickly. Wasn't the outrage over 30s appeasement a driver for the Cambridge Five to work for the Soviets?
Yes, it was, you know. I think one of what, and you know, that was certainly something that Walter was aware of, with the evidence of hindsight. But as Walter, and I mentioned this in the book, Walter wrote a very seminal essay in a magazine which had very limited distribution because it only went out to spies and retired Foreign Office people, called The Round Table. But he wrote a brilliant, brilliant essay in 1980, touching on this, something which has always fascinated me, which is this tension between the need for public disclosure and what is justified secrecy, and how do you navigate between the two. But in there, he talks a lot about the Cambridge Five, on his own evidence, and he makes the point that, of course, you know, one forgets that you know, during World War II, Churchill, who deep down from the minute the Bolshevik Revolution happened in 1917, was instinctively, he was a romantic imperialist, was instinctively anti-Bolshevik, anti-communist through and through, and certainly did not defend the Republic in the Spanish Civil War. And yet, you know, in World War II, he insisted that we had to have Stalin on side, you know. So, you know, at that time, what Walter was saying, is it at all surprisingly that we were recruiting good public school boys who went to the right clubs, spoke the same, with the same accent, in Philby's case, and McLean were incredibly personable, were great professionals, and did some pretty good work during World War II. All right, afterwards we heard that they gave secrets away to the Russians, but they did some pretty good work on the Germans, you know. But what Walter goes on to say in that essay is where we got it wrong was that we should have been much quicker off the mark in 1946, in terms of vetting everyone who was in Whitehall at the time, because we were into a totally different ball game once the Cold War was underway.
Well, thank you very much. And that really brings us to a close with this webinar. I'm sure we could go on for a long time. Maybe there's a part two of this, Jimmy. But I'd just like to thank Emily for hosting this and pulling this together, and for Jimmy for just a really insightful book. It's been an absolute joy being involved in this book club. So coming up at the tablet, we've got our Advent series of events and reflections, which I know some of you are attending. The next one is on Friday of this week, and that's Margaret Hebblethwaite talking about preparing to change history, the part of Jesus's mother. We've also got our Christmas campaign running currently, where you can give a gift of the tablet this Christmas to somebody either special or a missionary or to one of our prisoners on a waiting list or our school, and you receive a tablet 2024 calendar, which is very unique and developed by our designers. So if you're not a subscriber to the tablet or to the Pastoral Review, you can find all the details of how to subscribe at www.thetablet. And we're still running our development campaign. So the Tablet Development Fund, if you'd like to donate, you can still do that by going on to www.thetabletdevelopmentfund. I'd just like to thank again our guests for this evening. So we could have sat here a lot longer, but it's just been lovely. I was also watching the fire. It's been absolutely marvellous.